You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Monday the 11th of November 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioalbion.com. Well, I'm very pleased to say today that we have a very special guest with us, someone that I've been working with behind the scenes for a few months now, and he's going to be coming to join us at Radio Albion with his show, The Patriotic Weekly Review. So, of course, I am talking about Mr. Mark Cullett. Mark, thank you very much for coming on today. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing really well, thank you. And obviously, we have been working for some time, but I just want to congratulate you on the phenomenal rebrand of your site. I think it's a really, really positive move. And obviously, I'm very happy that Patriotic Weekly Review will now be part of that and part of your site. And I'm really looking forward to being able to stream to more than one location. So it'll be on YouTube as always, but now also available for people who want to view it over on your site as well.
Yes, we've got a video player coming, so we will have Radio Albion TV, so we will have audio and video. The show will go out on the audio stream, the normal radio stream that all our listeners listen to, plus we will also now have our own video streaming server, which obviously you can make use of, and we'll have the MP3 available for all the Radio Albion listeners to download. Because obviously that's a bit easier for some people than watching things on BitChute and all the rest of it. And we'll also set up an RSS feed, so it will go out automatically to people's devices. But that's all the technical side of it, really. I mean, I've followed your growth really over the last 20 years, Mark. I mean, from before I was a nationalist, I first saw you on documentaries with Russell Brand, and the Dispatches documentary years ago. And I wasn't a nationalist then, and I can remember watching them and thinking, I don't know why they hate this guy so much. I can't work out why they don't like this guy. He's not saying anything that is out of the ordinary. He's not saying anything that people don't think themselves. Some of the things he's saying about gays may be seen as a bit offensive, but that's just the normal language that lads use at around that age. And I felt very sorry for you when the journalist came out and said that he'd been secretly recording you and then tried to twist your words, particularly about a bit where you pointed out that the Germans had a very happy and peaceful and society back in the 30s. And you pointed out that it wasn't so nice for the Jews, but for the Germans, it was, you know, what was wrong with that? And anybody looking around Bradford today would have to admit that life was better back then. And this guy was trying to make out that that was the equivalent of you saying you wanted to gas Jews. And I can remember thinking at that time, this is so wrong. And I wanted to know what happened to your anti-immigration flyer that you were really pleased with making. I wanted to know about what happened to your audiobooks. And I wasn't on the internet at the time, sadly. So I wasn't able to find all this out. And then years later, I discover nationalism and I become a nationalist. And I find that, you're pretty much leading the British movement now, and you're still a nationalist, and, you know, you've grown and matured in that time. And I just wanted to let you know that effect you had on me back then when I wasn't a nationalist. And I wonder how many other people there are that happened to. And, you know, I just wondered your thoughts on those documentaries or anything that you wanted to say about that. Maybe you'd want to talk about that a little bit.
Well, firstly, I've just got to say thank you for such kind words. At the time when that happened, I was obviously quite upset by it, because I wouldn't say I fully trusted the journalist, but over time, when you work with somebody for that degree of time, I mean, he followed me around for over 6 months, you sort of do get closer to them. And there's certain things that you find like common ground, you start talking to them. And I would certainly say the one big takeaway from this is never, ever let a journalist follow you around. And that's something, though, that people should have known at the time. I mean, I have repeatedly sort of apologized because I felt it was quite embarrassing for me. Also, it'll be a bit embarrassing for the movement as well. But one thing I'll say is I would never, ever have given a man of my age the chance to take part in something like that. And looking back on it, I think it's very sort of foolish of the party to have done that, to have put me in that kind of position. And I would certainly say in the future that all young nationalists need to be protected from that. And when we do deal with the media, because some people say, oh, we should never deal with the media. But obviously, I think that was a mistake. I think that if we control what we do with the media and control situations, it can be beneficial for us. But that means when we go and speak to the media, we should guarantee it's in a neutral place, not in our own homes, not in somewhere we're unsure of, not out in the street, but say make them book a room or a conference area in a hotel. So we go and sit down and we know we're not going to be accosted. We know that we're not going to be judged for anything that might be on show. And also, when we go to these meetings, we should always, if we can, take somebody with us. And we should record both sides of the argument. So if they do try to twist our words, we have, at the very least, audio recordings of exactly what happened. So if they say, well, you know, listen to this explosive interview, and they present sort of 30 seconds of different snippets, we can say, well, actually, it wasn't such an explosive interview. It was a very well thought out discussion. And here's the full 2.5 hours. I think that puts us in a much better position. And when people are following you around, and this is just sort of a little aside, when they cut things together, they cut things together very creatively. And because people have got a very short attention span, they use what's called cutaways. So they will focus on the person that they're interviewing, that they're making the documentary on, but then they'll cut away to something in the room which they want to use as illustrative of the person they're interviewing. So if they're interviewing someone they like, for example, a war veteran, they might cut away to a picture of him on the mantelpiece in his uniform, or a selection of his medals that are mounted in a case hanging next to a bookshelf, because then he looks good. It paints the picture of who he is. But if they want to make you look bad, they look for things in your house that might make you look bad. Now, everyone has off days. And what I mean by that is, let's just say, for sake of argument, that it's been really, really windy the night before and you haven't yet put your bin out. They will take a cutaway of the bin that looks a little bit too full, or they'll take a cutaway of some, you know, a coffee cup that you haven't washed up. And that is to give the impression that you're dirty, that you're unclean, that you can't take care of yourself, that you're not sort of a good, decent person. And when you allow these people into your house, they seize on everything like that in order to splice information into the overall finished product, the documentary, to colour people's opinion of you. And whether people consciously notice that they're doing that, it doesn't really matter, because they subconsciously will. And that's why you always want to do things in a very neutral and controlled environment. So it reduces their chance to play those kind of tricks on you. But 20 years later, you know, obviously hindsight is a wonderful thing. And, you know, I apologize at the time for any embarrassment it caused, but I think this is all a learning process. And one good thing about this is it does put me in a much better position for the future when giving advice to young nationalists.
Well, I think that comes across really clearly in the content that you produce, your concern for younger nationalists and the advice that you give on how not to get into trouble, like some of the ways the things you've talked about recently about not bothering Muslims, not going into mosques, not announcing that you're having a demonstration, not being confrontatory. And you can tell that you've put a lot of thought into these things. And it's obviously of great concern to you, young nationalists. And, you know, we don't want bad things to happen to them like did happen to an organization a couple of years back. Also, I think back at that time, the devices weren't available to record the interview yourself, and they are now. And there's been a lot of success with people recording interviews alongside the mainstream media. Just recently, Rasmus Paludan managed to do that without the journalist knowing he was being recorded, which was pretty hilarious, actually, when he put it out online. But since then, you've also written a book, which I was really impressed with, because it seemed to me to have a totally different view of things than has been said before. I mean, you get books before which will concentrate on IQ, they'll concentrate on crime figures and all that sort of thing. But your book focused on the id and the ego and the psychological aspects of the nation. Obviously, we've talked about nations before as nations having a spirit and nations having a soul, the same as an individual does. But I'm not aware that anybody has ever looked at it in the psychologist's way, using the psychologist's language like that. So where did you get that idea from? And can you tell us a bit about the work that went into producing that book?
Well, thank you for those kind words. When I was writing the book, I wanted to come at it from the angle of what has reduced us to the state we're in now. And when you look at what turns sort of brave, proud people into something much, much less, which is what we've become, it's very easy to blame these things on other people, to say, well, look here, you know, we've imported these low IQ migrants. Look here, we've had our free speech taken away. Look here, you know, this has been done to us. But it's more sort of illustrative to actually look at the way it's been done on a psychological level and the processes which have taken place over a, you know, number of decades, so that people can look at themselves and say, well, this is how that affected me, and maybe I can reverse that social engineering, because then it becomes more than just sort of a catalogue of disasters, but it can actually work as a self-help book. And that people will say, well, wow, I was basing my ideal self on something that was totally unsuitable because the mainstream media put an unsuitable role model in front of me. And that's one of the central themes. Really, it's all based around Freudian psychology and the fact that when Freud developed his model of the mind, the id, the ego, and the superego, that model has been used by Hollywood, the music industry, the advertising industry, and it's been used by to devastating effect in order to influence us and to turn us into what we've become. And they've done that in numerous ways. And one way I've just touched upon is role models. So they split young people away from positive role models, and then they present negative role models, because they know that people's morality, people's superego, is implanted via role models. People copy the behavior of others. So if you put somebody good in front of young people, so if you put a successful soldier who is clean, neat, tidy, somebody who's got great time management skills, who polishes his shoes, who puts everything in order in his home, somebody who keeps fit, somebody who eats healthily, who goes to bed early, who doesn't drink a lot, they will seek to emulate the role model, and they too will become ordered, decent, and they'll become good and productive members of society. But if you put somebody in front of young people, like say Amy Winehouse, and this is the example that I actually used in my book, Amy Winehouse, there's a statue of her in London. Well, why would you build a statue to somebody who was a drug addict, an alcoholic, somebody who actually killed themselves due to their own devotion to destructive, hedonistic vices. Well, you'd only do that if you wanted all the young people who looked up to her to also do that. And we know our enemies are working towards our destruction, but that psychological view allows people to look at things and go, oh my gosh, this is what worked on me. And I've had so many people write to me and said, thank you so much for writing this because I was hooked on this or I was addicted to that. And then I realized that I was just chasing this sort of warped morality. And once I got my sort of pleasures under control, because most of these things are done very cleverly, they're also done via pleasure. So they seek to make you want to eat more. They seek, and it's natural to want to eat, isn't it? It's natural to get pleasure from food. But once you go down the road of gluttony, you're ruined. You know, it's natural to want to find somebody of the opposite sex and indulge in a healthy sexual relationship that leads to children. But it's unnatural to be addicted to pornography and to view highly sexualized material all day. And these people, the people who've done this to Europeans, are very, very clever in that they've given us this kind of hyper hedonism where everything's turned up to sort of a, you know, 200%, and we're bombarded with it so that we give in to our animal instincts, pursue these pleasures at the detriment of not only ourselves, but also the wider community. And I hadn't seen anyone write anything along those lines before, so I thought it was quite not only a fresh take, but it was also something that wasn't overly academic. It wasn't anything too wordy, and it wasn't something that relied on dozens or hundreds of notes and sort of little things, breadcrumb trails that people had to follow. But it was something that people could just pick up and read who weren't necessarily political and could actually take something productive from it.
Well, I very much like the way that you've made it available for free, and you've also got the book version that people can buy, because it's information that people need to see, and those that want to support you can buy copies of it. It's there's a link to it in the sidebar at the Radio Albion site. And one of another things that has impressed me about you is the way that you don't just talk the talk, you walk the walk. I mean, you put across this image of somebody with good morals, good health, a positive outlook on things. You're not a pessimist. The glass is half full for you. It's not half empty. And you set a good example. And that, to me, has always seemed to be the most important thing in nationalism. We need people that set a good example, that don't just talk about these things, but live these things. I mean, even when you look at the people that attack you, if you look at Hope Not Hate, the image they most use of you is you are on a push bike looking super healthy, super fit, as if you've just, you know, you've just done 10 miles on a cycle race. And that is a good image. You know, to think that the enemy uses can't find worse images of you than that. I mean, there is another one that they use, but just as much of the time I see you on this push bike, and that looks fantastic. And I know you don't just encourage people to come along to conferences and meetups in wine bars. You encourage people to go on runs and assault courses, and you do all this health work, trying to keep people healthy and fit. And again, that's a very important thing that we don't really see. Many of the nationalist personalities that we see making podcasts actually doing. You know, you're a bit of an everyman. You're getting involved in everything, and I think you're setting a really good example with that. And the latest venture is the Patriotic Alternative, a movement, a political organization, a think tank, a vehicle for people to meet up and get involved and take things offline. Which finally we've got a proper organization in Britain, which is ethno-nationalist, which I've been waiting for so long, for a good organization that I can get behind at Radio Albion, and all the hosts we have at Radio Albion, and we can encourage people to join this organization as well. Do you want to talk a little bit about the Patriotic Alternative, Mark?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And thank you for the kind words. Also, on the bike ride, I actually had done about 10 miles by the time that had been taken. That's actually in Dolby Forest in East Yorkshire. And that's I think it's about a 22-mile ride on the Red Route. And it's a really intense day out. And it's actually somewhere where I hope to take some young people. It's a really, really intense route. But if people are up for a day of incredible exercise and incredible scenery, that would be a great place to have a nationalist event. But on to Patriotic Alternative. For me, the big thing was that we as nationalists have so much in common with ordinary people. Ordinary people, if they were sat down and were shown sort of a piece of paper with our core values written on it, I think something like two-thirds, maybe more, would agree with 90 to 100% of what we actually stand for. Yet when it comes to it, we don't get that level of support from ordinary people. So you've got to ask yourself, what's going wrong? Well, what's going wrong is often ourselves. We're our own worst enemies. We package up this fantastic message in the worst possible way. We wrap it up with sort of hooliganism, often violence, antisocial behavior, alcohol, all kinds of negatives. And I've seen this over the last couple of decades of involvement. You know, I've been to meetings where what's being said is spot on, but the people at the meetings, some of them anyway, are people who have got a real negative stigma attached to them. And I often thought to myself, well, if we could just get rid of the people with the negative stigma attached to them, if we could just smarten ourselves up, if we could present ourselves in a much better and more professional manner, and if we could appear more open, more welcoming, more normal to the public, then we wouldn't have a problem. Because the problem isn't our core message. That's something that people want to buy into. The problem is our packaging. So the idea of Patriotic Alternative was to set a standard, to set this ideal where we have rules, where we have codes of conduct, where we have a dress code, so it attracts the right people, so that we're setting a template where people can say, right, I want to start a local group. But it has to be smart. People have to come dressed well. People have to abstain from getting horribly drunk or behaving in an antisocial manner. So the wrong types are kept away. And conversely, the right types are attracted. So we build something that people want to be part of, so that people want to bring their wives, their girlfriends. People think that they can invite their mums, their dads, their friends, their work colleagues. Because in the past, as much as we might hate to admit it, being a nationalist has had a lot of stigma attached to it. It's been something that you might not want to tell your friends and family, that you might not want to invite your girlfriend along to because of the kind of people she might meet that might put her off listening to your viewpoints. And really, that's what I want to tackle. I want this to be a premier movement, and I'm basing it very much on what we've seen on the continent. I mean, last weekend I was at Erkenbrand, a couple of weekends ago I was at Skanser in Copenhagen. Earlier this year, I was at the Finnish Awakening Conference, and earlier than that, I was at Skanser in Stockholm. And all of those countries have these wonderful, very professional organizations that I'm talking about, organizations that don't accept people who are scruffy, they don't accept people who want to come and get drunk, they don't accept people who are coming because they hope there's going to be trouble and want a good scrap. They only accept people who are bright, professional, people who want to be part of something genuinely productive that can reach out to normal people, and that normal people would be not only proud to be involved in, but would actually be inspired by. And that's exactly the kind of thing that we want to achieve in the UK. Because you've got to remember, nationalism in the past, nationalism pre-Second World War, was something that was actually very, very attractive to be a part of. It was full of businessmen. It was full of lecturers, teachers. It was full of professionals. And it went on to build movements that were power-winning movements that people actively flock towards. But post-Second World War, nationalism has become something that's, in a way, unfashionable. And that's because we ourselves often have bought into these negative stereotypes and played up to them. People have played up to the image of the Hollywood Nazi. People have come along because they thought it was a movement for hooligans where violence would, be found. So hooligans who wanted to find violence came and found the movement. And I want to reverse that. And they've reversed that on the continent already. And it really is time that Britain caught up with those excellent movements I mentioned earlier. And we started pulling our weight in this struggle.
It's about upholding standards, isn't it? You know, you got to uphold a positive standard, a positive moral standard, and then people will be encouraged to join it. And it takes some courage to be self-reflective like that, because the mainstream media attacks us, it slurs us, and it's very tempting to say, well, these are all lies, and none of this is true. And it takes some courage to actually look at what is going on in nationalism and say, well, hang on a minute. No, we haven't got all the best people. We have got a few bad eggs, and numbers aren't everything. It's quality that matters. I mean, when you look at race, we say it's quality that matters. It's not the quantity. It's not that you have so many different people. It's the quality of the person that matters. It's the quality of the race that matters, not the quantity. And it's the same thing with nationalism. It's the same thing with individuals. And again, I 100% agree with you this here, that it's these standards that need upholding. And if you can set out guidelines for this, then hopefully you'll get these different franchises throughout the country, and they'll all be keeping to this same standard, and people will come and join us. I mean, as you say, before the war, we had generals, we had upper class people that were involved. You only have to look at the members list of the old British Union of Fascists to see how different that is from today. I mean, we do have some academics now that are joining us. And you had Dr. Edward Dutton at the conference last time. We have Dr. Kevin MacDonald. We need more people like this to join us and to be a part of the nationalist movement. And we need to distance ourselves from the hooligan part of it. And eventually, hopefully, the hooligan part might change their ways. I mean, part of the changing from Radio Aryan to Radio Albion is to reach out to more people. Our content isn't going to change, but the fact is that the content was only reaching a limited number of people, and there are so many more people that would benefit from it, because as you say, Mark, what we are talking is just common sense, and it does appeal to the man on the street. It's just getting that information out there to them and putting it in a package that is appealing to them, which is what I'm hoping to do here now. What plans have you got for the future then with the Patriotic Alternative? Because recently you did your survey, the We Were Never Asked survey. Have you got anything like that planned again for the future, or was that a one-off?
That certainly wasn't a one-off. And at the moment, we're discussing how to follow that up. I think when you do something like the We Were Never Asked survey and the documentary that followed, and I've got to give huge credit here to Laura Towler. Laura Towler is an amazing lady. She is the deputy leader of Patriotic Alternative. She was the one who came up with the idea of We Were Never Asked. She was there on the day of action. She edited together the documentary. It's absolutely phenomenal, the work she put in. And I didn't imagine it being as successful as it has been. It's been an absolutely huge, I think it's been seen by over 70,000 people already. And that was the last time I checked, so it might be many, many more now. And when you do something that's successful like that, it's very, very difficult to know how to follow it up, because it's such a phenomenal piece of work. And we are talking about what to do. I mean, the first thing we decided upon was that we weren't holding enough conferences, because the number of people that wanted to come to the conference, our first conference in September this year, it was double the number of seats we actually had available. So we could have had a much bigger venue. There was demand far outstripped supply. So the first thing that we're going to be doing is having Northern and Southern conferences to allow people to come to either or, depending on where they live. And this makes it a lot easier for people, because before, the travel was, you know, quite a lot of traveling if you had to travel from the South Coast right up to Manchester. So that's the first thing. Secondly, we will be doing a number of events that we've done before. We will be doing the camps, we will be doing the fitness events, we will be doing the lunch meetups, you know, on a Saturday or a Sunday. But I'm hoping that in the new year, we can potentially follow up the We Were Never Asked campaign with the We Will Not Be Replaced campaign, which would be a leaflet-driven campaign where people could download the leaflets, print them off, with any print-on-demand printer who print them very, very cheaply, send them back, and groups all over the UK can go out, not into city centres where they might get into some trouble, but go out and leaflet housing estates, leaflet tower blocks, and actually go and take our message to the general public. And I'm hoping that Patriotic Alternative can bridge that gap between the internet-based movement that we've got, which sometimes can be a little bit of an echo chamber, and that huge blue ocean of support that we're not quite reaching just yet.
That's a fantastic idea. That's a really good idea. And again, it's making use of the up-to-date technology that we have now with the print on demand. I mean, you couldn't have done that 10, 15 years ago, the same as you're making use of the technology with the live hangouts and all the podcasts and the internet revolution. I mean, nationalism is not stuck in the past. You know, we need to be making use of all the latest technological improvements and advancements, which is what's going to carry us on into the future. Well, we're getting near the end of the podcast now, Mark. Your podcast is on Wednesday. I think that's right. It's 7 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. That's the Patriotic Weekly Review. People will be able to hear that on the Radio Albion stream, and also on the Radio Albion, watch it on the Radio Albion video stream. What guests have you got for us this week?
Well, yes, this would be a phenomenal first week with you guys, because we've got Lana and Henrik on from Red Ice, and they'll be talking about their deplatforming, their plans in the wake of the deplatforming. And they're such an important couple of guests, and the reason they're such an important couple of guests, you spoke earlier about people who keep wittering on about how depressed they are and how down in the dumps they get about everything, and that they're so black-pilled about the state of our society. But Lana and Henrik, even though they've been through so much, they are absolutely red-pilled. They're people, sorry, not red-pilled, white-pilled. They're so confident, they're so full of energy, they're so hopeful for the future. And despite all the trouble they've had, it hasn't seemed to dampen their spirits at all. They're still fighting just as hard. I was on their Halloween stream. It was an absolutely phenomenal night. And there are a couple of guests that I always love having on. So it's going to be a big show, not just because of the excellent guests, but also because we will now be live on Radio Albion at the same time.
And they fully deserve our support, Henrik and Lana. I do enjoy watching their Weekend Warrior, and I've subscribed to them for quite a few years now, and I do recommend our listeners do the same. I mean, it's rare that you actually have a nationalist media organisation that has a functioning business, which they do have. So do send them funds, do support them. Do also send funds to the Patriotic Alternative. Do check out the Patriotic Weekly Review on Wednesday, and I'd like to say thank you very much for coming on today, Mark. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Mr. I. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.